You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to All My Best Friends Are Digital, a podcast about video games and the stories they tell. How are you doing, Caitlin?
I am great. How about you, Mark?
I think great is an understatement. I'm doing quite well, thanks very much. We, as per usual, are going to be talking about video games. We're going to be talking about what we've been playing lately. We're going to be talking about a retro game in our Goof segment, Gaming Opinions on Old School Funware, and I, for one, am psyched to tell the entire world about Dino Wars Destruction of Spondylus. I don't know if I'm pronouncing Spondylus correctly, but we can have a discussion about that. Our feature game, as chosen by our dear digital best friends, by our patrons, is The Case of the Golden Idol. And then finally, we're going to be engaging in our Shout segment. I, for one, am going to be hijacking Shout, altering the acronym, and issuing some modifications, whereas Caitlin will actually be engaging in some shameless hyping of upcoming titles. But let us first begin at the beginning, as is appropriate. Let us talk about what we've been playing lately. Caitlin, other than Monster Hunter Wilds, is there anything that you've been playing lately?
Yeah, so I played some Final Fantasy IV. I got caught up to the stopping point in my Final Fantasy Not a Book Club. I see Kane definitely had a thing for Rosa, which I totally had forgotten about. But, you know, he's a dragoon, so he's still cool, even though he sucks. But I'm gonna just move on. I'm gonna move on from that.
Well, so what's the stopping? What do you mean the stopping point in your Final Fantasy IV book club?
Okay, Final Fantasy IV is not actually one of the first long Final Fantasies. I think that's either going to be Final Fantasy V or VI. VI is definitely pretty long. I think IV can be finished in roughly 18 to 20 hours if you're playing the Pixel Remaster.
Is that with skipping random encounters or not?
No, I don't think so. I think that's okay. Like the actual game length if you do pretty much everything.
Huh. I remember it taking a lot longer than that in the Super Nintendo days.
So do I.
But then again, yeah. But then again, that was a long time ago, so who's to say?
Yeah, but we chose a stopping point for, you know, that was roughly in the middle of the game for us to get to, and then we're going to talk about it later today, and then we'll finish the game and talk about it again in a few weeks.
Well, give us a sneak preview. What are your thoughts so far, other than Kane being problematic?
I like it. I mean, there's definitely some nostalgia going on here, because every single piece of music I hear just, you know, brings me back however many years. But I'm enjoying the story so far. I like that there's real characters and they have, you know, thoughts and opinions. So definitely, like, as my friend Jared put it, the first a good Final Fantasy. Actually, he really likes Final Fantasy I, but that's okay.
You'll forgive him anyway?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Final Fantasy I, that also has, like, major nostalgia stuff for me. So I don't dislike it. I just don't think it was as good as my nostalgia wants it to be.
Fair enough. Again, I only dimly remember my experience with Final Fantasy IV, but going back to Dragoons, I could never take them seriously because of how long they spent in the air. Was that ever a problem for you?
No, but I get it. Like, what are you doing up there? Like, how high are you jumping? Why are you waiting to jump back down? Like, what's going on?
Oh, maybe that's it. Maybe it's like Batman. They're like perched on something nearby watching and waiting. So they haven't actually jumped however high they need to jump to stay in the air for whatever two or three turns. They're just perched on a gargoyle waiting.
Yes. Yeah, maybe that's
okay,
it.
I like that version later. It's strange what we will and won't accept. Like, some old dude summering meteors from the sky, whatever, that's magic. But if a Dragoon jumps into the sky so high that it takes him about 60 seconds to descend again, I'm like, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Like, I don't know if the idea... I mean, I don't even think there's any dragons. In fact, in most of these games, the dragons are, like, dying out or have died out. So I could understand if he was, like, jumping up and then, you know, flying around on his dragon for a minute and then choosing a time to dive back down. But that's not the case, so I don't know.
Oh, you're unfamiliar with what the word Dragoon actually means, then.
Well, in the Final Fantasy world, Dragoons are often, like, dragon knights. That's the case with Kane, but, yeah.
Well, because Dragoon doesn't actually have anything to do with dragon.
Yeah.
As an actual term. I can't speak to the connection in various Final Fantasy games, but it's just they're just false cognates. They just happen to be similar. A Dragoon is just mounted infantry. That's what Dragoon means.
Yeah. Final Fantasy world brings dragons in, but...
Even by the time of the Napoleonic Wars, that had already begun to shift, and thank you for asking about the Napoleonic Wars, because I would happily talk to you about various unit types in the Napoleonic Wars, but I think, Caitlin, personally, despite your enthusiasm, we might have to return back to video games as a primary topic of discussion for today.
We'll just put
a pin in that for later.
Sure. Another one of the games that I played this last week was The Last Meadow. It's a joke game.
A joke?
By what? Discord. So it was a Discord April Fool's game. It's going to be gone by the time this episode airs. I think it's supposed to be available from April 1st to April 7th. And it's like kind of a idle clicker game, like cookie clicker. And you have to touch grass.
I have understood roughly 2/3 of the words you've used. Let's back up.
Okay.
Joke game.
Yes.
What is a joke game?
This is a April Fool's... I mean, it's a real game, but it's meant to be silly. And, like, as an April Fool's joke.
Okay. Because mostly my familiarity with April Fool's on the internet is a chance for people who are not particularly funny to try to deceive you.
Yes.
Now, there are some exceptions. I actually highly recommend my boy Tech Dweeb's April Fool's video, because it is simultaneously clever and well-executed on the one hand, and on the other hand, given that it is an inevitability that any joke on the internet will be taken seriously by some subsection of people, there is no actual negative consequences for anyone who does take it seriously. But in this case, you're saying that it was a joke that actually exists.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know what the plan is or whether they just decided to put a bunch of time into something that was only going to be available for a week. But it's an idle clicker game. So, you click, you touch grass, you get basically money, and then you use that money to buy things that can touch the grass for you in order to get more money. And eventually it becomes a whole thing, but they use a lot of like internet culture in it, including, of course, touching grass. The whole
right.
There's a trailer you can watch for the game on YouTube somewhere. It's very silly, but it was fun. It only took maybe, I don't know, 15 minutes or less of, like, active playing with it to do anything. And it reminded me of my days playing, like, Adventure Capitalist and Realm Grinder, which are, like, two mobile, like, idle clicker games that I had enjoyed a lot back in the day.
I've never played an idle clicker game. I mean, so the joke of it seems relatively transparent. The idea of a video game where you are touching grass, already there's some parody going on there.
Yeah.
To, you know, fully drive the joke into the ground by explaining it, even when it was transparently obvious. So what is an idle clicker game?
So,
I mean, you are making me feel a million years old, Caitlin. I half expect the next words out of your mouth to be skibbity toilet or something. No cap.
Have you never played Cookie Clicker?
No, I'm utterly unfamiliar with Cookie Clicker.
Okay, Cookie Clicker.
Did it leave its family behind?
No, not to my, not as far as I'm aware. But if you look up Cookie Clicker, it originated as a web game where you click and you get a cookie, and then you could spend, you know, you click a lot, you get a lot of cookies, you spend those cookies to hire grandmas to bake the cookies, and then you'll automatically get some cookies generated every, you know, X seconds, and you keep hiring more and more grandmas. And then eventually you can, like, upgrade the ovens and I'm half making stuff up just because it's been so long since I played Cookie Clicker. But the idea is that you just keep doing things to generate more and more and more cookies or money or whatever the currency is, in order to get more and more stuff. Number go up. That's the whole point, is number go up. That's an idle clicker game.
This seems like an excellent crossover opportunity. I might be able to make a licensed version of my criminally underappreciated board game, Roll a Six, Win a Cookie.
Yeah, that's true. You have other people rolling sixes for you and getting cookies, and you can use those cookies to hire more people to roll sixes.
Outsourcing can make everything better. Delegation. Delegation and outsourcing. I can have an army of people in the subcontinent rolling sixes for me. I just need to find a way to get the cookies here. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then finally, the last game that I played last week was 33 Immortals. As we mentioned when Mark shouted it out, I think either last week or the week before that, it's not a real game yet. It's available on Game Pass as a preview, which is their kind of version of early access. But my Tuesday Night Gaming group wanted to give it a try, so we did. And it was pretty neat. It gives me Hades vibes, not in a it's going to be as good as Hades kind of way, because I wouldn't dare to say any game will be as good as Hades, because Hades is, you know, a thing of its own. Ultimately, when you start up the game, there's three total worlds that you can play through, at least right now. And the only one that's available to you at the beginning is called Inferno. Inferno is a 33-player map. If you happen to beat Inferno, then you'll get a key for Purgatorio, which is 22 players. And while I didn't beat Purgatorio, I assume if you beat that, you'll get a key for Paradiso, which is 11 players. So you have slowly smaller and smaller groups. It's pretty neat. I believe you even brought up like Rabbit and Steel when you first mentioned this, just because it's another way of introducing kind of raid mechanics and stuff to in a different genre or in a different way. So with 33 people in a match, you have a handful of things you can do. You can like grind normal enemies, find powerful enemies on the map that will let you loot a chest when they're dead, and you get random upgrades. It's a roguelite. The permanent upgrades tend to be stat related, so eventually you can get enough currency to upgrade your health or upgrade your damage, and you can equip multiple upgrades the higher level you get, and you gain levels by completing, I think, something called feats, which is like you killed 1,000 things with a bow, or, you know, achievements, basically. Yeah, it's interesting. I played solo once, which was a lot less fun. And I played with my group on Tuesday, which was pretty dang fun. There's some like co-op abilities. So, like, you know, you get enough power and you can basically use an ultimate ability, but you need to team up with more people. So you hold in a button and then these three. Okay, I played Bo. Everybody's so surprised. But I activated my ultimate. And when I activate my ultimate, there's two spots for other players to go to. And when they go to it, they hit a button, and then it actually activates the ultimate, which, like, rains arrows everywhere. Every class has their own version of that. And it's pretty neat. I think 33 Immortals has a lot of potential. I probably won't be playing it solo very much, just because, I don't know, it didn't feel the same not having, you know, a group of buddies to wander around with. But I'm excited to see where it goes.
Cool. I'm definitely willing to give it a shot once it is a real game, and I respect your reticence to not do it before that. But yeah, with a group expressing interest, that is exactly the kind of thing where I might be willing to try a game in progress, especially since, again, it's on Game Pass, so it's not like you're going to be paying to participate in a closed beta.
Yes. Yep, that's for sure. That's been nice.
I'm very glad it chose Promise.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing what they do with it. I hope that, you know, they build it up even more than it is right now, because it's quite fun, but I have no idea if this is supposed to be the whole game or what.
Yeah, it's tough to tell. Sometimes it changes a little, sometimes it changes a lot, sometimes they decide to break it just before the 1.0 release.
Yeah, that's sadly more common than I wish it were. So, Mark, what have you been playing lately?
I've been playing Rogue Loops. It is also a roguelite thing within striking distance of Hades, because a lot of roguelite games are pretty slow and stodgy and feel a little bit more like a MOBA or like an RTS in terms of pacing. And then there are ones that believe in invincibility dashes and rather more fast attacks and a little bit more Hades-like. And Rogue Loops is definitely in that latter category. Now, I played a demo of this last year, and I was quite intrigued. And the full version was released in early April. And I decided to do something uncharacteristic and give them some money, in part because there aren't any roguelites that I'm currently playing. And a lot about Rogue Loops is very brisk. Your movement and attacks aren't quite as fluid as in Hades. Like, for example, your dash is on a significantly longer cooldown, and you only ever do one dash. So in that sense, you feel a lot more limited in terms of movement. But in the context of how the game works, it's fine. It's not that your mobility is out of proportion to what's going on, but it's a very tight environment. The Rogue Loops refers to the central gimmick in that every level just consists of two connected levels, two connected spaces, and you're constantly cycling back before them. And at the start of every session, every instance, every what would be a room in another roguelite, you are given a choice between two pairs of attributes, one a buff and another thing that applies to that room. So for example, you may be like, get a new skill, or get a new artifact, or get a significant buff to your ability damage, or a significant buff to your attack damage, or what have you. And another thing that I often bounce off of roguelites for is if those upgrades don't feel good.
Right.
You know, the classic example is, you know, plus 6% critical hit chance. I'm like, no, miss me with that. I want something cool. Not all the upgrades in Rogue Loops are amazing, but they all feel substantial and I all understand how they would be useful and none of them immediately strike me as useless. So that part's already great. But every upgrade, every buff, is conjoined with some additional threat that is going to be applied to that level. And the real interesting thing is that debuff, that threat, that additional variable applies to every time you step back into that room. You're alternating between rooms A and B. And so what you get are these mounting series of concatenating awfulnesses. Now you might say, oh, but Mark, don't some of those combinations lead to near unwinnable situations? Yes, I encourage you to avoid them. What this does, though, is it leads to an immediate sense of escalation and an urgency to the combat. Things escalate very quickly. The difference between one awful debuff and two awful debuffs in conjunction, suddenly you're at three awful debuffs in a room, and then you go back to the other room and it's got a different set of three awful debuffs, and you're like, oh crap, this nightmare again. And it's all very difficult in a satisfying way. There's no opportunity for there to be, oh, okay, a whole bunch of rooms before I get to the first boss, and then finally things start to escalate. Because a lot of these roguelites, again, they have these runs that are 45 minutes, an hour and a half. And there are times where that's okay, but much of the time I think that that's a wasted opportunity, especially when you can do the alternative and have a constant sense of progression leading to quicker, more visceral runs. And Rogue Loops does that in spades. And so I appreciate its vision on pacing. The only part that I don't really like is that the stages themselves are a little bit cluttered. Like, the view that you have is very, very far away from the action. So everything's very small. Like, your character and all the enemies are reasonably small, even smaller than they are in Hades. And in Hades, they're not particularly big. But in Hades, most of the rooms are reasonably open. There's a pillar here, there's a pillar there. This might be a bit of a pit, and so you can't fall into it or anything, but it's just you can't walk over this area. You can only dash to the other side. Rogue Loops levels are far more cluttered in nature. They've got a lot of places where you can't go, which feels all the more limiting because the stages are so small. You got these two stages that you're constantly bouncing back and forth between. And this, in many ways, makes some of the modifiers more deadly than they need to be. So, for example, one of the threats that you can pick is you can strew explosive barrels around randomly on the side of the level. That's okay. You know, they indicate the threat area with the classic red circle on the ground. You know to get out of there, so you do with dodge, it blows up. Okay, move on to the next one, and they're randomly scattered about the level. So there's usually some place for you to go that isn't Barrel Town. But another similar modifier, which is rated as having the same difficulty, is that there are traps strewn about the room. And I thought, oh, okay, maybe one or two traps. No. There's usually like four or five traps. And they're big, and they're in the middle of the room. And consequently, whenever I am forced or choose to do those modifiers, I end up playing on a tiny little section on the map because a vast swath of it is within the threat range of these static traps that you can't do anything about. Now, again, sometimes that's the choice you have to make. But all told, I think that although the mobility is roughly about right and the pacing is just about right, I don't necessarily appreciate that much of the time I feel like smart play involves me just huddling up in a corner and not really moving around very much, just dodging within a tightly constrained area of geography. That and so far I can't get more than one of the characters to work. So very much like Children of Morta, the conceit is that the characters, the protagonists, are a family. And you unlock them as you proceed through the course of the game. So far I've unlocked two family members, but I can only make one of them work, and that's the starting one. The archer, actually, I just cannot get to work properly. She's just very not suited to my playstyle or something. I just haven't figured out how to get her to function. And that's a little bit of a downer so far. I'm hoping that the next unlock I get will at least be someone I feel is viable.
Yeah.
And then I'll get a little bit more of the variety. But so far, I've been having a blast with Rogue Loops. I think it's very, very well done. As I say, I'm enjoying the upgrades. The meta progression similarly gives you upgrades that feel consequential. I don't feel like I'm just making very, very minor incremental progress towards meaningful stat buffs. There's just a very good feedback loop of threat and strength advancement that is characteristic both inside a given loop and of a macro progression. And so couple that with some satisfying moment-to-moment action, and Rogue Loops has been very diverting as far as I'm concerned.
It looks pretty neat. So you said that when it's time to choose a room, you basically have to choose an item or a buff and a affix or something that's going to follow you for the rest of the run? Like a bad thing about the rooms?
So every level is composed of a large room with two halves. And you alternate between the two halves before you get to a boss, and then you go to a new room.
Right.
And each half of a room remembers all the terrible things you've put there.
Okay.
So I show up at the start of the game. I'm in the north half of the room, for example. And I decide to pick up a new artifact, which gives me some ability. I can pick between some artifacts. And of course, there are rerolls and all the standard trappings of these things.
Yeah.
And I also decide that this one is going to have the exploding barrels. I finish that. I kill all the enemies there. I then go into the south half of the room. I still have the artifact. And now it tells me to add something terrible to the south half of the room, like flaming trails that divide the room into sections. Okay, I select that. I then go back to the north half. It's going to have exploding barrels plus whatever I pick for it now.
Okay.
Now it's going to have exploding barrels plus a vine that does damage to me and trips me up. And they just keep adding and adding and adding. And part of the challenge is just keeping your head straight so that you don't lead to an unwinnable combination.
Yeah.
And also just adapting to the fact that you're going back and forth. So the benefits follow you from room to room. The right. benefits keep stacking, but the terrible things that you're adding only apply to that half of the room.
Okay.
And it is in your interest to make sure that they stack with each other in the least painful way possible.
Yeah. So do you have to alternate between rooms, or could you do the top half twice and then do the bottom half?
No, you're stuck alternating back and forth.
Okay, you have to alternate. Okay, neat.
It is the eponymous loop that you are roguing.
Ah, yes. All right, yeah, that sounds really cool. I might have to check it out.
I encourage anyone who's remotely curious to try the demo. So that's what we've been playing this week. We're now going to move on to gaming opinions on old school funware, a.k.a. Goof. I am ready for pure joy. Are you ready for pure? It's not pure joy, but it's a lot of joy. There's a lot of joy to be had here.
Yeah, I'm ready.
Dino Wars. This is with a Z. This is what you Americans call a Z.
And a Y.
D-Y-N-O-W-A-R-Z. My calling it Z applies a 45% tariff on the letter. Destruction of Spondylus. How do you say it? Is it Spondylus?
That's how I've been saying it. I mean, it okay. never appears in the game, so...
Well, this is an NES game. We're not going to have voice samples. Thank
well,
you very much.
Sure, sure.
And if we did, it probably wouldn't disambiguate. There were... NES games with digitized voice samples. Blades of Steel, for example, has a very overused voice sample.
Okay.
That I can mostly understand what they say. It's something about a pass. There's a pass involved, but it's a sports ball game, so things get complicated there. Anyway, Dino Wars, Destruction of Spondylus, and yes, I'm going to use the full title every time, was published in 1990, designed by the Advanced Communication Company. Are you familiar with the plot of Dino Wars? Destruction of Spondylus, Caitlin, did you read the rule book?
So I desperately wanted to know what the game was about, and therefore, yes, I did bring up the rule book. And I think that the blurb for the story is incredible, and I think that we should recite it.
Go for it, Caitlin.
Something was terribly wrong in the distant man-made Spondylus solar system. One by one, the planet's central life support computers had been infected with a life-threatening virus, while the planet's surfaces had been overrun with giant computerized dinosaurs known as Robosaurs.
Robosaurs.
Under attack in his laboratory on Alpha Planet, Professor Proteus, the mastermind of the Spondylus system and founder of the Robosaur Project, suddenly realized that this deadly sabotage could only be the work of his former partner, the deranged Dr. Brainius.
Oh no!
Years earlier, the doctor had fled Alpha Planet after Professor Proteus had exposed him for performing forbidden robotic experiments on human subjects. At last, he had returned to seek his revenge using the professor's own creations. But little did he realize that Proteus had been hard at work for the past few years perfecting the ultimate robosaur, Cyborosaurus. There was only one hope to save the Spondylus system. Cyborosaurus must be unleashed. The Dino Wars must begin.
Adding to this is the fact that Dino Wars Destruction of Spondylus has one of the most bomb-ass covers in... I mean this sincerely, in yes. entire video game history. It's I don't so good. Know... It's amazing. Go look it up. I'll have a note. I'll have a link in the episode notes. It is outstanding. So we've covered all the great parts about Dino Wars.
Yep, that's it.
I have so much affection for this title, except for playing it. So you blow off your cartridge, you put it in your NES, and you are treated to one of the stodgiest. I use the term loosely, action platformers. And here's the thing. So there are two different game modes. You either control Professor Proteus, or you are playing a Professor Proteus in his Cyborosaurus. Not Cybosaurus, not Cybersaurus, Cyborosaurus. Get it right. He didn't go to 4 years of Proteus grad school to be called Mr. Proteus. Thank you very much.
Yeah, come on.
When you're running around as Professor Proteus, you're this tiny little sprite, and you're running around, and this is very kludgy platforming, which you'd better get right, because you only got one life.
Oh my god, yeah.
And if you miss one of the, and let me get this right, the platforms of deception, that's what they call it, then just hard game over. Just sucks to be you. Like, at least, in their defense, they don't give you a stun lock animation when you get hit.
True.
Which is great, because you get hit all the time.
Yep.
So, yeah, you can jump through bullet fire and land on the platform of deception if you've timed your jump right, which you might or may not do, because, again, the platform is pretty sludgy.
Yes, it really is.
You then get to a... I'm going to charitably call it a boss. This is a boss in the same way that somebody looks at the end game of Metroid and said, that's too dynamic. We need something even more static and boring. And it's a good thing you checked the manual, because if you weren't able to check the manual, we didn't necessarily know. After you blow up the thing, you have to double back and go back to the beginning of the level.
Yep.
To get in your Cyborosaurus. It's a day in the life of Professor Proteus.
Yep.
How would you characterize the transition to and ultimate playing as the aforementioned Cyborosaurus?
So the little barely animated, like, quote-unquote cutscene graphics are pretty good. Like, I love
amazing.
Seeing the... Yeah, they're so good. Like, seeing the dinosaur... Or the Cyborosaurus's eyes light
thank
up.
Thank you.
And
It's really cool.
Yeah.
And I'm normally not weak to, like, super robot aesthetic. I like a little bit more military-style giant robot stuff. So slightly more Macross than Gundam. More Full Metal Panic than Get a Robo. Things like that. But this was great. And so this happens, I'm like, yeah, bring on Cyborosaurus. Why does everyone hate this game? And then, it's terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. It has so much style, and I desperately wish that any of the gameplay could live up to even 10% of the style.
In fairness, a lot of video games have tried to capture the appeal of being a giant stompy monster or robot, and it's hard to do.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to be a slow-moving, sludgy character. And on top of being slow-moving and sludgy, the final insult is that when you control Cyborosaurus, its default attack is the most puny punch I think I've ever seen in a video game ever.
Yeah, the T-Rex arms. Like, what little do you
stubby
expect?
T-Rex arm.
There's power-ups and weapons, and each weapon has 3 upgrades, but you only get the upgrade if you have the weapon already. So, you know, for example, there's like a flying punch weapon, and if you don't have any weapon when you approach it, you get a flying punch where your punch becomes like a rocket that goes out and then up and then back and back to you. But if you accidentally or on purpose pick up another weapon before you pick up a second rocket punch, then you just have level 1 of whatever that weapon is. Some of them are truly terrible.
But surely, Caitlin, it must be easy to just avoid the upgrades you don't want and take the upgrades you do.
If only. That stodgy platforming you mentioned earlier, you are forced to jump over any upgrades that you decide not to take. And that is not easy, because your jump distance is roughly the width of one of these weapons that's on the ground.
Yeah, you can barely jump over them if you time your platforming jump correctly. So if it's too close to a ledge, you're SOL.
Yep.
They're strangely tall as well. Like, there are cases where I thought I would walk above one, but no, on a higher level. And the worst part for me, and I had the same problem with a lot of NES games, why is it so difficult for these NES games to have a whole bunch of different kinds of upgrades and leave me completely in the dark as to which one's which?
Yeah.
Like, I spent actual effort to try to remember which upgrade looked like what, and I my success rate was roughly 33%.
Yep. Yeah, there's a laser weapon that I like, you know, as much as I like any of the weapons. There was a laser weapon that pierces, and that one I enjoyed. And then there was one that looked almost exactly like it, or at least, you know, I never saw both of them on screen at the same time, right? So I was like, okay, that one is a terrible bomb that you launch out of the top of your head and lands a few feet in front of you. And I could not keep these straight, and I kept accidentally picking up the wrong one, and it was terrible.
And the enemies come in 2 different kinds. Both classic examples of 8-bit nonsense. You have the small, fast-moving ones that are annoying unless you're able to hit them off from the other side of the screen with an actual weapon, unlike the bomb or the normal punch.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are the larger Robosaurs that take a large quantity of damage and you engage in very, very slow and attritional combat with, or you just jump over them and call it a day, which in some cases I think is the appropriate response.
Yeah.
I don't know when I lost my patience with the actual gameplay of Dino Wars Destruction of Spondylus, because this is one of those cases where the really cool transition scenes and the ridiculous cover art and the absurd setup, the juxtaposition with the awful gameplay wasn't the kind of thing where it's like, ugh, you're totally spoiling the premise. Instead, my enthusiasm for the background stuff helped me muscle through a lot of the bad gameplay.
Yeah.
But I think the thing that finally killed me was the crushingly repetitive level design.
Yes.
Because you're alternating between stomping around in your Cyborosaurus and being Professor Proteus. But the Professor Proteus levels in particular, you see the same rooms over and over again.
Oh my god, yes.
Just with slightly more enemies, slightly more flying hounds of destruction, which is what they're called.
Yes. Oh god.
And meanwhile, the Cyborosaurus levels, to even call it having level design is a bit of an exaggeration. It's just hardly any design goes into it. There's a couple pits here and there, and maybe a section with some ranged platforms, and just the same old Robosaurs that come at you from the right side of the screen.
Yeah. Other than a couple new Robosaurus types being introduced later on, there's basically no enemy differentiation. The stages all look exactly the same, except they're palette swapped. I mean, okay, not exactly the same, but you would be hard-pressed to say whether you're on level 1 or level 5 just by looking at it. They all look very, very samey. And then, like, there wasn't even a good payoff for finishing it.
Yeah. It's true.
I have never been so disappointed. Like, you go up and it's like, okay, credits.
There's definitely a tipping point with Dino Wars, Destruction of Spondylus. And I definitely reached it far sooner than I... The mere fact, again, the quality, the absurdity, the joy yes. of much of Dino Wars is so potent that it would take a truly mediocre NES game to sap you of it. And here we are.
Aww.
So this is another game that we have plucked from the obscurity of your childhood, yes?
Yes.
Did you play it as a child or you just had it with you?
I did play it. I don't recall if I ever beat it, although because... So yes, you do get a game over when you die, but you can just continue and you'll continue from the beginning of whatever level you died at. It barely takes... Okay, other than your frustration and loss of joy because of how not good the game is...
Yes.
It's not like it's hard to beat it. You will get to the end if you are just persistent enough. At one point,
yeah,
I think
easy.
I fell down the same stupid hole in a Proteus level like 6 times in a row and I was getting real mad. But it's not hard. Just, you know, some of the platforming really sucks. So there's like platforms that move left and right and you have to time your jump so that you land on the platform and not fall in the hole and...
Of course they're tricky. They're platforms of deception.
You're right. I wanted Dino Wars to be so much better than it was. And not, it doesn't deserve it. This will never happen. But I would love if somebody remade Dino Wars. Like, and obviously improved the gameplay and stuff. But I just think that the story and the concept is so batshit crazy. Like, I love it. So much. I just wanted it to be better.
It's great. Dino Wars Destruction of Spondylus. It's fun to say. I just like saying it. I would put a framed print of the cover art on my wall.
Yes. So good.
But I'm not going to play the game again.
No.
But thank you, Caitlin, for bringing the Dino Wars into my life. Thank you for unleashing the Cyborosaurus into my heart.
Yes. Anytime.
So that's Dino Wars Destruction of Spondylus. We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors.
Sometimes it feels like the world is moving at hyperspeed and you can't keep up because it's one thing, then another, and don't forget the meeting and the yoga class and the dinner reservation, but then... You get into the all-new Nissan Murano, and you feel the breeze from the panoramic moonroof, while the massaging seats melt away the tension of the day. And you realize that sometimes the greatest rush is not rushing at all. Shop the all-new Murano at NissanUSA.com. Panoramic moonroof massaging leather appointed seats are available features.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
And we're back. We put a vote to our dear patrons, Caitlin, to our digital best friends online on Patreon, and they voted overwhelmingly in favor of The Case of the Golden Idol. This was developed by Color Grey Games, initially released in 2022, later ported to various other platforms over the years, with various improvements of quality of life, some extra DLC of some extra cases, and then there's a sequel. Caitlin, why don't you tell us all about The Case of the Golden Idol?
I don't think that Mark or I had any idea what to expect going into this.
Went in blind, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a deduction game. In The Case of the Golden Idol, you select a case, and the first case is The Case of the Golden Idol. The other two cases are DLC. And you're able to explore the story chapter by chapter. And every chapter is basically a scene frozen in time that's usually limited to a single location or like a location and the areas around it. Maybe multiple rooms in a house or the interior and exterior of a single place. And in each one, there's people and objects you can click on to inspect. You'll find underline words and letters and stuff that you can click to add to your bank of words and names that you get to use later. And then there's generally a single required statement called a thinking panel that you need to fill out in order to progress to the next chapter. And that's basically saying, like, what happened in this scene? So you're presented with a statement, and I'm going to use the very first one in the game as an example. And it's going to be first name, last name, pushed, first name, last name, from a cliff in the noun of noun on Monkey Paw Island. And you basically do ad libs with the words that you put in your word repository to fill that out. And if you're correct, then you get to move on.
And indeed, as the chapters go on, because the first chapter, the first scene is very much a tutorial.
Yes.
It's very circumscribed, a very small inventory of words. And that Mad Lib style text that Caitlin read is far more verbose than things even in the very next scene.
Yes.
They typically take more of the scene of first name, last name, blanked, first name, last name, over blank, because blank, blanked, 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 first name, last name.
Yes.
No, I mean it. Like, typically, it's just a very, very, the thinnest of structures.
Yeah.
Where you have to fill in not just the people involved, but what they did and why. Instead of the first scene where you're already told the crime. Now, granted, I'm not spoiling anything, but the first scene literally shows somebody plummeting off the side of a cliff and someone else in a clear pushing motion.
Yes.
So it's not like the Mad Lib is telling you anything you didn't know, but the structure tends to be more parsimonious as you go on.
Yeah. And then, so in addition to these required thinking panels that you have to fill out, most of the chapters also have optional thinking panels, which are, as I said, completely optional. Filling them in might help you out with filling out the required one, ultimately. One example is you have to deduce who got what in an inheritance. So there's a bunch of shredded up pieces of paper that all say, you know, who got what. You'll usually have to decide, okay, this person is Andrea somebody. This person is Thomas. Who's a what's it? So you have to decide who all the people are. Sometimes you'll get some auxiliary information that you can fill out. And then you have, of course, the required thinking panel that you have to fill out.
And frequently there are several optional bits, which are basically kind of like elaborated note-taking mechanisms. So frequently step one is just identifying by name who are these people in this mise-en-scene that you're given.
Mm-hmm.
Because you, as a character, aren't really a character at all. You're kind of like some disembodied force that is just observing things, and you are given no context.
Yeah.
Just, here are the things you can see. You can rifle through someone's pockets. I'm actually, sorry, even phrasing it that way gives the player far more agency and presence in the actual game. It's just the game has a stylized way of presenting you with various unconnected facts. And as Caitlin says, there are going to be sometimes these proper names. Like, for example, you see that someone's carrying a newspaper. So you click on the newspaper. It blows up the front page of the newspaper. And you can see in the headline that there's a proper name in the headline with the little squiggly underline. Okay, you click on that proper name. You click on the first name. You click on the last name. And those two names get added to your list of people. And that list can be used to populate the optional side panels about who got what, the optional side panels of who in the heck any of these people are, as well as later on, when you need to fill out the actual solution to this puzzle that you've been given, all the first name, last name bits. Their first name is there, their last name is there. Now, why the game feels the need to disambiguate first names and last names ever, since when they are presented in conjunction, like if it says in a newspaper that Tom Jones gave a lecture about what it's like to stuff a sock into your crotch, then I don't know why later on when it comes time for me to fill in the answer, it has Tom and Jones as two entirely separate bits of data. Whatever. That's a minor quibble, but that's just how the game functions. You spend the first part of every scene clicking on everything you can. Just click on all the underlines, you get an inventory, and then you start slowly piecing together what happened and answering the specific questions. That's the overall thrust of the case of the Golden Idol.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, this is definitely not my type of game. It reminded me a lot of The Root Trees Are Dead, which also is not, like, really my typical kind of game. I think the case of the Golden Idol it's pretty good. I can see that, like, for the kind of game that it is, it's really well done. It's not one that, you know, seized my attention. I'm probably not going to go and play the DLCs. I am glad that I played through, you know, the base game. Yeah, I don't know. So it's, I overall, I didn't think it was too difficult. I did think the hints were absolutely worthless.
I found the hints almost insultingly useless.
Yes, I tried them. Like, I got stuck on the third or fourth level at one point, and I was trying to figure out what I needed to do. And I went through all four hints, and I was like, thanks, I knew all of that information already. Like,
let's start with the third scene. The third scene is when I first started making use of the hints. That's how good I am at solving these kinds of puzzles. And the first hint was, you might want to consider who got what in the will. And I'm like, there's literally an optional section in the information organization that lets me write down who got what in the will.
Yeah.
You've already told me. It would take truly a spectacularly unintuitive person or someone completely unfamiliar with the structure of puzzle solving in general,
mm-hmm.
or someone completely outside their cultural milieu, or all of those things in conjunction, to have paged through all the menus and not realized that it might be consequential who got what in the will. You already told me that. This is not a hint.
Yeah.
Thanks, buddies. It was so weird.
Yeah. A lot of thanks for nothing.
I was optimistic. I specifically remembered, oh, look, there's a hint system. Maybe it's designed for numbskulls like me. And I remembered you, Caitlin, talking about how good the hint system was in the Root Tracer Dead. I'm like, oh, great. Yeah. Maybe there's some contextually relevant hints here. These people are obviously very clever. They obviously like puzzles. And so maybe they're really good at giving me a hint that helps me unlock things in an organic way rather than just telling me, you know, X marks the spot. So I start clicking on the hints like, this is almost insulting.
Yeah.
Like, either this information is something you've already gleaned, or if this is actual news to you, I'm amazed that you're able to play this as a game at all, frankly. And if you can't, no shade on you. I'm not saying that makes you an idiot or anything. It's just, if you can't have figured out by the contextual clues already that the will was, who got what in the will was salient based on the fact that the game has already basically told you that, I don't know what you're doing playing the Case of the Golden Idol. Go do something else with your life, and more power to you.
Yeah, and it's very possible that the hints are better in other chapters of the game, but I gave up on them after, you know, a couple chapters because, like, these are worthless to me. And then the only hints that I used are really, like, kind of the quote, cheat hints, where it tells you what things are wrong.
Yeah.
So, yeah, every now and then it's like, okay, I can't figure this out. I have the thinking panel filled out. It has multiple items wrong. I did like that it would tell you if you had two or fewer incorrect things, because that usually helped. Like, I was often able to fix it if it was at that state. If it was at, you know, there's wrong information here, that it's like, okay, yeah. I need to obviously consult the thing that will tell me which blocks are incorrect so that I can move on.
The vastly more useful hint system is when the user is kind of close to the answer, but they can't get that to that last bit. Like, in several cases, I was in an instance where, I know the names of these two guys, I just don't know which one's which.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just blunt force it.
Yeah.
And that's fine. If you want to blunt force it, you can, but you're not obliged to. And so that element of the game giving you hints was vastly more successful. Because if you're way off base and you've got half a dozen different details wrong, the game just tells you that you're just flatly wrong.
Yeah.
And it only starts giving you more detail once you've got two or fewer details wrong. That I thought was great. That part was perfect. You can't really blunt force it from the beginning. But if you want to just get to that last step, you can blunt force it. And that was the more successful hint part.
Yep, I agree with that.
Now, like you, Caitlin, I too am not the target audience of the Case of the Golden Idol. And I've made my position on puzzles in video games very clear.
Yes.
I respect them, but they're not for me. And to a certain extent, let me say one thing about the setup of the Case of the Golden Idol that's good and one thing that I think is bad. The thing that I think is good is, unlike a lot of other games that are puzzles, these are organic and not forced. They're organic in the sense that a lot of people love puzzle games like The Room, and I don't mean You're Tearing Me Apart, Lisa. I mean that game where you just walk into a room and there's a puzzle box there. And that's how the game starts. Like, ooh, a puzzle box. My thought would be like, why do I need to open this box? Like, what?
Yeah.
And there's no context, there's no setting, there's nothing. Here, it's facially obvious in the scene what's what. Someone's dead.
Yeah.
All right, that provides an automatic setting and context and structure for me to try to figure out who this person was, who killed them, why were they killed, etc.
Yeah.
So good. That feels organic. It feels natural. And it is sufficiently organic and natural that it completely blows away any concern someone might have about who am I, the player in this instance? Who cares? Doesn't matter.
Does not matter.
The part that I don't like is that this feels to be very much like a bunch of people who very, very much liked 1990s era point and click adventure games, but didn't like all that pesky writing, characterization, or plot development. And just wanted to skip to sensible and organic, but puzzles.
Yes.
Just want to rip them all out.
Yeah.
I like the characterization. I like the plot developments. I like the good writing in a lot of adventure games, right? So like this provides a nice bookend, a nice like counterexample to some of the, you know, 6-hour-ish walking simulators that we've really liked. I'm thinking of Fireworks. I'm thinking of Still Wakes the Deep. Games of those elk, of that elk, right? Where the quote-unquote puzzles were ridiculously straightforward, but we cared about the people and we cared what happened.
Yeah.
Case of the Golden Idol is the diametric opposite of what's going on in those games. I don't care about any of those people. In fact, we don't really know enough about any of them to care about any of them.
Yeah.
Insofar as there's an evolving plot, it's mostly about just what happens to this idol and some weird secret mysticism surrounding it. Fine. It gets the job done. It strings the murder mysteries together. But it's all just stripped of context and nuance and texture. All that we have are these deduction puzzles. And that's okay, but I felt like it was missing something.
Yeah, I would have loved to know more about these characters to maybe give a crap about anything that was going on, because I just did not care, because there's, you don't have any information to care. So the only thing that matters is solving the mystery of what happened in the scene. Not even the mystery of what happened. You know what happened, like Mark said. Figuring out exactly how whatever happened happened. But that was genuinely fun at times. I really liked one where I had to do math because it made me feel smart, unlike most of the other puzzles in this.
Yeah, a good puzzle can make you feel smart. I'm not blind to that joy. And a couple of times, while playing The Case of the Golden Idol, I got to do that. It's like, ooh, I've pieced this together. I will say, though, that a couple of times, roughly about as many times as the game made me feel genuinely clever, I felt that The Case of the Golden Idol stumbles into, it's like, well, I can tell you want me to make this intuitive leap, but I don't think that that's an appropriate one. This feels forced.
Mm-hmm.
You know that kind of puzzle logic that I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I can't really give too many examples without going into spoilers, but just as an example, there's one puzzle where it matters what day of the week the scene you're watching is.
Yes.
And there's a newspaper somewhere. And you're supposed to infer that because there's a newspaper with a date, that that is the date of the day. And I'm like, okay, fine. That's what you want me to do, but people have old dated newspapers around. All right, fine. Imagine that, but like 10 times worse, where I just, it really is an artificial feeling puzzle. And those parts kind of are just as bad as the good parts are at making you feel clever. And I did not appreciate those elements.
Yeah, there were certain leaps of logic that The Case of the Golden Idol clearly wanted us to make that I certainly did not make on my own. And there's times when I'd like to be like, okay, how do I know that this is what I was supposed to get out of this piece of evidence or this collection of evidence? And I don't think it's as obvious as, you know, the developer obviously thought it was. You know, that's okay.
I do actually think that the incredibly gamey, abstracted setup does help a little bit with that, at least, because it's not like this is phrased or framed as some kind of legal drama where right. You have to marshal evidence, right? This is not Phoenix Wright.
No.
Where you have to present it even in an absurdly comical court of law. This is just you jotting down notes about what you think happened, right? And there, at least, the standard of evidence is lower. It's just, I think that sometimes the puzzles are really well designed, and even for somebody like me who doesn't like puzzles like this, and then sometimes it was really like some combination of, I have no idea how you expect me to get from point C from the evidence you've given me, or sometimes I'm only getting to point C because it's so clear you want me to, and this feels forced.
Mm-hmm. Did you play with the classic UI or with what do they call it? I forget what they call the new UI, but they updated it recently.
I don't know. I just played the version on PC Game Pass. I don't know which version that is.
Oh, okay. I played it on Steam, and in the startup, it gives you an option of classic or Redux. I ended up playing Redux, but in classic, all of the words just kind of get gathered at the very bottom of your screen. In Redux, you have like a little journal on the bottom right corner that you click and you can see them all.
Then I played in Redux.
Okay. That's what I would overall recommend for anybody who decides to pick up The Case of the Golden Idol. It seems to be a little bit easier to deal with everything.
They wanted to pretend as though you could play the game with a gamepad, and that lasted for me about 30 seconds. This is so obviously a mouse game.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't even try because they were like, hey, you know, you've got a control. It's like, nope. I realized that things are saying A, like I should be hitting the A button right now, but no, this is a mouse clicky game.
One of the improvements that they made over the course of the year since it was released was to make it more playable for people using a Steam Deck. Which is admirable, but frankly, were I playing it on a Steam Deck, number one, I'd put aside the Steam Deck and use one of the better PCs I have. But number two, I would just use the trackpad, frankly, because the joystick controls... I've seen better approximations of joystick to mouse cursor things. I appreciate the effort. Good job. You probably earned that Steam Deck certified badge that you get in Steam or what have you. But this is a mouse clicky game, no doubt about it. My recollection is that you've talked about The Root Trees Are Dead. You enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm.
You said that Obra Dinn gave you motion sickness?
Did.
Because the return of the Obra Dinn is an obvious point of comparison. Like, the designers have pointed to it as an inspiration. The designer of The Return of the Obra Dinn has lauded The Case of the Golden Idol as being great. Unsurprising, they're very similar kinds of games.
Yeah, I certainly tried to play Obra Dinn, but I couldn't make it work. Because you're walking through the ship, but the ship is very, like, black and white kind of... It's difficult for me to even describe what it looks like, but it's 3D, but kind of 2D at the same time, and it made my brain really sad. So I felt quite ill after playing it for a little while. That said, I think that there might be a mod or something that I can do or try someday that would allow me to change the field of view. I don't know if it'd be any good, but I keep thinking that maybe someday I'll try that and see if I can do it.
I don't want your brain to be sad, but as a video gamer, I do know the cure for brain sad. Do you know what that is, Caitlin?
What is that?
Number go up.
Number go up?
Number go up, cure brain sad every time.
That's true.
So look, all told, The Case of the Golden Idol is not something that I really enjoyed. But for the kind of game that it is, I can recognize the craft. I appreciate what's going on. And I found it far, far less obnoxious than a lot of games where I either was unmotivated by the puzzle or couldn't even perceive that a puzzle was being asked of me, which is often one of my problems. The setups were evocative, very straightforward about why you were being asked to do what you were asked to do. The solutions mostly made sense, even if I sometimes couldn't figure out the details that were being strewn. Overall, it seldom felt too painfully artificial or contrived.
Yeah.
That having been said, there were some instances of forced logic. I miss character and texture and context that might have made me care a little bit more about the proceedings. I mean, I can't remember ever having been so unmoved by a series of grisly murders, frankly.
Yeah.
But for a different audience, I can totally see why The Case of the Golden Idol would really, really land. If you like puzzles, if you like deduction, if you like putting together these pieces and taking notes and stuff, absolutely give it a try. But quite frankly, not for me.
Yeah, the art is so cool. Like, it definitely has a sense of style. I enjoyed seeing some of the characters change and age over time. There are a lot of very cool things about The Case of the Golden Idol. I am very glad that I finished it. Probably, you know, like I said, I'm not going to play the DLC just because it didn't grab me like a game would if I was going to actually make that jump. But it was really well done. I still don't know how much I liked it or not. probably, you know, I liked it more than I disliked it, but I'm not the target audience, as you said.
Well, that's going to do it for the case of the Golden Idol. We're now going to close things out with Caitlin's going to engage in some shameless hyping of upcoming titles in our shout segment. Caitlin, what would you like to shout out?
So I'm going to shout out Mario Kart World. I put in my name and email for the Switch 2 pre-order stuff, and then the pre-order was immediately indefinitely delayed because America and tariffs. So, you know, we'll see. We'll see. Maybe I'll get a Switch 2. Maybe I won't. Maybe I'll... We'll see. I have a lot of thoughts and feelings that I'm just going to put aside. But I loved Mario Kart 8, so I'm looking forward to seeing what Mario Kart World is like.
Good stuff. I would like to issue a perhaps one-time modification of the segment. I would like to announce that I have serious hesitations over upcoming titles.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So this is a follow-up to a previous shout. Several months ago, I believe, I shouted out Garou City of the Wolves, Fury sequel that I've been waiting for 26 years. I've also commented in the context of SNK that since over 90% of it is owned by a Saudi fund run by Mohammed bin Salman, that there was sort of a gloom, a shadow over the future of SNK. Not because I've got anything against Saudis, but because I have something against murder. And unfortunately, recent developments in City of the Wolves have made this an unavoidable connection. What am I talking about? Okay, so they started announcing some of the cast, and it started out on a real high note. Andy Bogard was coming back. A whole bunch of other really good Fatal Fury characters were going to be in there. I was super psyched. And then they announced a guest character, Cristiano Ronaldo. My understanding is that he is a player of the game of the football. And I've got nothing against the football. It's just not my thing, and I don't understand what a football player is doing in a fighting game. Mm-hmm. All right, okay, but he's famous. I've heard of him. I know he's a thing. All right, okay. Then the second guest character was announced. Caitlin, have you ever heard of a DJ named Salvatore Ganacci?
No.
So he's the next guest character, and they released a launch trailer showing him engaged in some very, very silly dance fighting moves, beating the crap out of Terry Bogard, and I suddenly had very strong feelings.
Yeah.
I didn't watch the trailer where Ronaldo is beating the crap out of Terry Bogard. I just mostly tried to ignore it. But then when they announced the second one of this weird DJ that a lot of people haven't heard of, I'm like, what are you doing to Terry? I started to feel bad. I started to feel indignant on behalf of this fictitious guy. I'm not alone. A lot of other people, even people who have less strong feelings about Fatal Fury.
Yeah.
And then somebody started connecting the dots. I don't think this is overall conspiracist. Here's the detail. And like, this is an odd pull. Like, Cristiano Ronaldo, fine, I guess. He's super famous, whatever. Also, the fact that they've hired voice actors to do these characters, also super weird. They're real people. Have them voice their own characters.
Okay.
This is bizarre. Here's the thing. Please tell me by the end of this if you think this is me in front of a corkboard with string connecting dots together.
Okay.
Cristiano Ronaldo plays in the Saudi Pro League. He plays for the team Al Nassr. And Salvatore Ganacci has done several events for the Saudi government. And so here we are as SNK fans saying, yeah, when you got bought out by MBS's pet fund, you said that the Saudis were going to have zero input in your creative decisions, and now we've got these two bizarre, seemingly random guest characters, both of them with very pronounced Saudi ties. Is it the case that the Japanese dev team sat and said, of all the gettable celebrities in the world, the two people we want are Cristiano Ronaldo and Salvatore Ganacci? These are the people that we want in our fighting game.
Yeah.
And suddenly that shifted this from, like, oh, who's the next guest character going to be? Zendaya and Chris Pratt? Like, straight to, these are people who are big in Saudi. And it's fine to be big in Saudi, that's fine. But now this has gone straight past joke characters in whom I have no interest, and straight on into every time I see them in the character select screen, I'm going to be reminded of chopping up a journalist with a hacksaw.
Yeah.
Now, am I a hypocrite for previously being able to dissociate the fact that I'd be helping the nonprofit agency of a murderous tyrant? And now the product itself is indelibly stained with that association, at least in my mind. Maybe that makes me a hypocrite. Maybe that means that my principles are very shallow. But frankly, if you had asked me 6 months ago, what could make you not want to get the new Fatal Fury game?
Yeah.
I would have said, I really can't think of anything. And guess what? Now I know. I am not getting City of the Wolves anymore. Because, as I say, every time I see the select screen, I'm just going to be reminded about who owns the company and how objectionable I find him and his works. And I'm sad. I'm genuinely sad. Because, to me, SNK is my gaming history. They are, like, the way some people feel about Nintendo, the way some people feel about those characters, that's how I feel about SNK and its stable. And before I was able to live in a state of self-deception or self-delusion or perhaps just convenience to say, well, okay, fine, yeah, that's who they're owned by, but they're just doing their thing and they're SNK. They're going to keep doing their thing. I don't know that I can live that lie anymore. And I'm sad.
Yeah, I mean, it's like they went out of their way to make it as obvious as possible. Like, I don't know. That doesn't feel good.
I mean, in fairness, just for further context, like, Salvatore Ganacci is genuinely enthusiastic about SNK products.
Sure.
Like, there are pictures of him, like, going years back wearing, like, Fatal Fury and King of Fighters t-shirts to various events and stuff. But, again, these two people, these two celebrities, one of whom is barely an international celebrity, I have to assume that this was either done at the behest of or to placate the Saudi ownership or audience.
Yeah.
And frankly, it doesn't make any difference to me. Now it's just, the association is just going to be rubbed in my face every time I play the game were I to do it. So that's it. I'm out. I uninstalled the beta. It's off my wish list. That's it. I'm done with that. For me, it ended with Garou. I still play Garou all the time. There's still lots of old SNK, but I'm off this train.
Yeah. I don't blame you.
Well, on that depressing note, tariffs and Saudi intervention. That's how we're going to end this episode of All My Best Friends Are Digital. Thank you so much, Caitlin, for being with me to process my feelings about Dino Wars.
Yeah, thank you so much. I had so much fun talking about Dino Wars' destruction of Spondylus with you.
We'll always have Spondylus, Caitlin.
We will.
Take care, everyone. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in touch, you can reach us at allmybestfriendsaredigital@gmail.com. Hope to see you again soon.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.